Okay, we are studying the book of Exodus. We're starting the book of Exodus tonight, and we're looking forward to that. Exodus, I'm on page 5. We're going to do the overview first. Exodus is the continuation of Genesis and tells the story of God's rescue and relationship with his people Israel. The actual Exodus event is dated about 1290 B.C., that Moses is the author of Exodus has been challenged, along with about everything else in the Bible, by modern scholars, but is attested to by Joshua, Malachi, Paul, Luke, John, Jesus, and his disciples, and I always side with Jesus and his contemporaries in these matters. The story starts where Genesis leaves off, with 70 descendants of Jacob moving into the land of Goshen in Egypt, and it ends at the foot of Mount Sinai with the construction of the tabernacle as a dwelling place for God among his people. So it basically is the first 2 years of their 40 years in the desert. Much of the story of Exodus is memorialized in the movie The Ten Commandments, so its main details are fairly familiar to most people. Cecil B. DeMille was respectful of the biblical text, produced a fairly accurate portrayal of people and events, even if he did have to imagine many of the details not covered in the Bible for the sake of the plot line. However, his imaginings are consistent with culture, historically appropriate, and biblically friendly. The Egyptian pharaohs of Joseph's day were Hyksos. We talked about this at length last couple weeks. They are a Semitic desert people who conquered and ruled Egypt between 1790 and 1550 B.C. This is a historical fact. The Semitic Hyksos were considered interlopers by the traditional Egyptians, but they would have been open to other Semites, like of Jacob's family, moving into and growing in numbers. When the traditional Egyptians regained power, they exhibited severe hostility against all Semitic peoples, enslaving them and practicing genocide. They also erased the names, images, and records of all Hyksosian achievements and deeds from their steles, public monuments, and libraries. This helps to explain the hostility of the Pharaoh who did not remember Joseph, which we will get to in one of the early lines of Exodus, toward the Israelites, and his enslavement of their people, the killing of their firstborn, and the lack of historical record concerning Joseph's achievements. It also squares with the biblical presentation of Joseph as a man who captured all the wealth of Egypt for his Pharaoh at the expense of the native people. Now, while Joseph would have ruled during the period of the Hyksos, Moses would have grown up and the Exodus would have occurred during the post-Hyksos period, known as the New Kingdom, 11 of whose rulers were known as Ramses. They were either Ramses or Setis, one or the other. While Joseph is only known through the Bible, Moses, the lawgiver of the Jews, was widely quoted and studied by Roman and Greek authors throughout their history. One key theme in Exodus that needs to be noted is the covenantal relationship offered by God to the people of Israel. This continuation of God's special relationship flows from his relationship to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the individual covenant bearers of the past. Now it is offered to an entire nation. This is what makes Israel the chosen people. As we shall see, it is not as much related to their deservedness as it is to God's purpose, which is to carry the light of God forward to the coming of Jesus the Christ, the Messiah. It is for this reason, to be the Ark of God's covenant, that Israel is brought to Sinai. It is only due to the faithfulness of God that it succeeds, because as with their forefathers before them, they are flawed, broken, outright sinful, and sometimes outright corrupt. While there are faithful individuals among the people, like Moses and Joshua and Caleb, the people are, as a whole, all too frequently unable to keep the covenant. It is for this reason that they need a Messiah who will rescue their hearts, not just their bodies, from bondage. This, then, is the overarching story of the Exodus, the redemption of mankind through the grace of God. Comments before we launch here? Okay. Stele. A stele is a stone that rises up out of the ground, and there's records written on it. Sometimes they're in the form, like for instance, the Washington Monument is a stele. Sometimes they're in the forms of a point at the center of them. Sometimes they're a column, but all around them are chiseled on all four sides records. Sometimes they're a flat stone, like a gravestone. They're called stele. I think that there's a single stele and plural stele. Stele, you know, they're both the same. Exodus 1:1. Now these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. They came each with his household. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. All the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number. But Joseph was already in Egypt, and Joseph died, all of his brothers and all that generation. But the sons of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly, and they multiplied and became exceedingly mighty, so the land was filled with them. So the 70 Israelites who came into Egypt were fruitful and multiplied. Joseph, you remember, isolated them in Goshen, away from the eyes of the Egyptians. He provided food for them when all the others were having to buy it. He gave them free land on which to live when all the native people were giving theirs to Pharaoh in exchange for grains and sustenance. The people of Israel were being made rich while the native people of Egypt were being made poor. The blessing of the covenantal patriarchs was passed down to them. God had a plan for them, so he prospered them mightily. The same thing happened in America among us. It is always God's modus operandi to bless Israel. It is an absolute stupid move to take a hostile position toward Israel or Israelis. It doesn't mean we have to agree with everything they do, nor does it imply that they are sinless or they don't do wicked things. But to take a hostile position against them as a people, or for the reason that they are Jewish, is to invite the direct and frontal attack from God. Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come and let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and in the event of war, they also join themselves to those who hate us and fight against us and depart from the land." Now, when he says that they are more and mightier than we, he doesn't mean all other Egyptian people. He means the ruling class. He means those of us who rule. So the people of Israel would have been smaller in number than all other Egyptians. But all other Egyptians would have been Cushites and various other people in Egypt. And like most people, the king or the pharaoh of Egypt would have thought of us as the ruling class, and all the other people as the farmers and the peasants and whatever. So when he says they are mightier or more in number than we, he means those of us who are trying to rule the place, the upper class. So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor. And they built for Pharaoh storage cities, Pithom and Ramses. These are the two cities that the Israelites spent a couple of hundred years building. Remember, they're in Egypt 400 years, but they're not in slavery for 400 years. Because the first 100 years or so they're actually doing pretty well. Remember, Joseph is living for 60 or 70 of that first 100 years that they're there. So, and even afterwards, they're not the target. You know, the new kingdom doesn't start for 100 years or so after they first come in. So, yeah.
We're still not Hebrew. We're not Jewish yet, right?
No, we're not Jewish yet. Right.
Okay.
Yeah, we're Israelites. The more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread out so that they were in dread of the sons of Israel. The Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously. They made their lives bitter with hard labor in mortar and bricks, and all kinds of labor in the field, and all their labors which they rigorously imposed upon them. So when the Hyksos were driven out, the new Pharaohs looked with askance at all other Semitic people in the lands, not just Israelites, all Semitic people. You remember that when later on, when we see the Israelites leaving under Moses' ownership or guidance, I should say, there are many peoples who join them in the Exodus that are not Jews or not Israelites. We'll see that at that particular point in time. Moses could not have married a Cushite woman had that not been the case. You know, we'll see that. One of the things that is a theme of Exodus is that Israel were aliens in a foreign and hostile land, and that other aliens join with them in their pain and suffering. Moses himself is an alien in Midian. And for that reason, the law of Moses is very strong about the treatment of alien peoples. So we'll get there. So in a possible war, especially with other Semites, Israel might join with the enemies of Egypt, they feared. To keep them from becoming stronger, the Egyptians enslaved all Semites, not just the Jews. Now, you remember from the movie Ten Commandments that Charlton Heston, the first time we see him, he is coming back in triumph from having conquered the Cushites, which is modern day or near modern day Ethiopia. Okay. Remember that he brings in this prince and princess, these black prince and princess, and all this goods and stuff, and that Yul Brynner says, make them kneel to Pharaoh, make them bow down to Pharaoh, which they ultimately they did, but Charlton Heston says, you may make them bow when you conquer them. And Seti says he's wise because he's made friends of his enemies. Well, later when Ramses is being successful at casting his doubt with Seti about Moses' loyalty, one of the things that he says is, well, with the Hebrew slaves in Goshen and the Cushites on the south, we are caught right in the middle of all these Semitic peoples. And Moses could take those slaves and turn them into an army. And Seti, that's what, if you remember the plot line, that's when Seti becomes concerned enough to ask Moses, you wouldn't turn these slaves against me, would you? And Moses gives him the answer that, you know, it's not right that men should be treated like burdens, beast of burden, whatever. And that's the point at which Seti basically has him arrested and tells everybody to strike his name from all the steals and all that sort of thing. Because he realizes that Moses could raise up the Semites and against him, and they would have a repeat of the Middle Kingdom with a Semitic group of people taking over the natives once again. Can't afford that. Can't do that. So to keep these Semites from becoming stronger, the Egyptians enslaved all Semites. To keep them from becoming too numerous, the Egyptians practiced genocide against male babies. Israel was compelled to build the Egyptian cities of Ramses and Pithom. The city of Ramses are also known over time as Zoan or Tanis. And Tanis is what it was called in the Raiders of the Lost Ark. That is the treasure cities. These were the treasure cities of the pharaohs. Enslaving minorities is a time-honored practice, but it only serves to make them stronger, and it results in them becoming more numerous. Their only self-expression and their only joy is found in bed with their wives and lovers. Again, God had a plan. That's, of course, how they become more numerous. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom his name was Shiphrah and the other his name was Puah. And he said, when you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth, and you see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, then you shall put him to death, but if it is a daughter, then she shall live. This is abortion. What he's saying is abort the male children. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the boys live. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and let the boys live? Midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous, and they give birth before the midwife can get to them. They are vigorous, Father.
I don't understand that.
They're saying that the Hebrew women have children without the help of the midwives. Unlike the Egyptian women, they don't have to wait for the midwives to come. They just have them at home. And
oh, okay. You can don't use the midwives.
Well, they would use them for cleanup, but the point is that they're saying that they've already had them by the time they get there,
Okay.
And then they're hidden from them or whatever. The Egyptian women are, and remember, once again, we're talking about Pharaoh's class of women. These are women who are delicate and been in, basically raised in upper class standards and whatever, and it's a very different thing. These women have been, working in the fields up until the point of labor, having the child and then moving on again. They've had a tough existence, and there wasn't any family leave plan for this group of people. So, verse 20. So God was good to the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very mighty. And it came about, because the midwives feared God, that he established households for them. And Pharaoh commanded all of his people, saying, every son who is born you are to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you are to keep alive. So this genocide is organized around the midwives. But these women feared God and would not kill or abort the children. Pharaoh then ordered Egyptian society to participate in the genocide, and soon abortion became a societal definer among the Egyptians, and a curse for which God would eventually exact payment. The later death of Egyptian children at Passover comes under the principle of sowing and reaping. Are we paying attention, America? The Egyptian society becomes defined by its abortion, and its penalty shows up in the death of the Egyptian children at the time of the Passover.
We obviously, the Bible has a record of all these things, such as the Passover and everything. Is there any, do the Egyptians have any record themselves of this, or do they just purge everything because it was embarrassing and they didn't want to think about it?
Yeah, there's some Egyptian records, like in Alexandria, but there's other records among the historians of the age. You're right. People very seldom. There's not a lot of historical record, even among us, about the atrocities done to the American Indians and stuff, except by those people who are counterculture among us, right? The victor writes history, and as we saw earlier, there all of this information was stricken. Once one group takes over, they go out and destroy all of the triumphs of the previous group, etc. So I mentioned earlier that although Joseph was not, is only basically found in the Hebrew scripture, Moses, on the other hand, is found widely reported on in the ancient world of the Greeks and the Romans. So there's enough, we're close enough now to other great powers that this history is protected in those places. Exodus 2, verse 1. Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi, and the woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket, and she covered it over with tar and pitch. Let me make a comment about this first sentence. When you have a scenario where there is an edict that the midwives the people are supposed to turn over their male children to the midwives or to the Egyptians for to be killed, you can imagine, based on our 21st century culture, based on our Western culture and whatever, you can imagine yourself fighting and struggling for the sake of your child. Don't read that back into this age. This is more like what happened even in later times in history, where people were came from more feudal worlds, and they were thoroughly intimidated by the ruling classes, and very often did things that that we would never even think about doing. Many people would say, well, we've got to give him up or else they'll come and put us in jail. And you know what I'm saying? They would just surrender on this. Now, I'll give you a little bit of historical perspective that you can relate to. You remember the movie Braveheart? In the movie Braveheart, the doctrine of prima nocta is featured, in which the lords of conquering groups would require, in this case the English, would require the first night of the marriage, of the bride's first night, to be spent in the bed of the lord of the feudal lord. So they would take the girl from the altar, and they would spend the first night. She would spend the first night in bed with the feudal lord, and then she would be given back to the guy. One of the reasons for doing that, the stated reasons for doing that, was because there was a high expectation of impregnating these girls, and then what would happen is that they felt like the stock would then be good Norman stock rather than Irish or whatever. The rite of prima nocta was practiced from time to time in different groups and different places. And you can imagine that if that were to happen in our particular world, that would be a pretty good scrap. But in this world, in the world where one group so dominates the group below them, people put up and have to put up with all manner of things that are absolutely horrible to us or detestable to us, and as much as they would hate to do it, they would put up with it. The girls would say, don't fight them because they'll kill you. I can put up with this. And they would just put up with it. They would hate it. They would put up with it. Now remember, in Braveheart, this is what caused William Wallace to go to war with the British, was because they came for his wife. Remember that?
Yeah, came for they had married and she...
But she had not given herself first night, and so the guy came for prima nocta. And William Wallace came out and fought them over this. In fact, he took the battle to the stockade and killed the nobleman in the process. And that started the war. Now, you also remember, if you remember the movie, that there were many around him who told him he was just bringing trouble on the rest of the village. And that people had been putting up with this for years. And what was so special about him? All right.
The women feared God, the Egyptian women. Why would they fear Yahweh?
Well,
the midwives.
They were Hebrew.
Forget it.
Yeah, because, I mean, once again, think about this. If you were had Hebrew midwives and they were terrified of the authorities above them, I mean, you know, you got to remember that. Now, by the way, the same premise was in the movie Rob Roy, if you remember.
Yes.
Okay. Because it was common in that particular age among the Normans and their whatever. But if you think about, for instance, what people did to people during the Third Reich, during Hitler's reign, what common ordinary people did to other common ordinary people because they were afraid not to. So people found themselves doing things that they abhorred, but they were afraid not to. And so we look at this and we go, well, how can, you know, why wouldn't these people just rise up and fight? Well, they were too beaten down for all of that. It was this particular family. Many of the families would hide their children, and these two particular midwives would cooperate with the process. But that doesn't mean they all did. I imagine with this many people around, there was more than two midwives around. We're actually, you know, given the story of this particular line. Remember, history is his story, and we're following the line, you know, from Adam to Jesus, and we're going through Abraham's descendants. And so we're getting the story of Moses. That doesn't mean we don't know what happened all around them, you know.
Garments that they wore then, it would be easier to hide the boys than it would be in our...
Well, especially for 3 months.
Well...
What you have to realize is once the kid gets to a certain size, the village knows. Mm-hmm. And if the village knows, the word goes out. Once again, the village is not...
They didn't have to hide them in just about 3 months?
No. They said they, in this case, they said they hid them for 3 months, and then they had to find a different plan.
Yeah, I don't know what
the details were on all that.
I was going to say, the garments that they wore then, yeah. All they'd have to do was keep the gals, the boys,
pink.
Let the girls' hair, grow their hair like the girls or something.
I've got pictures of my father in his youth wearing a dress with long hair.
Yeah, they look like girls.
Yeah. They could look like girls till later.
Yeah. But once again, if someone knows, and there's always, yeah. Well, if someone knows, and if there's, you know, there's money and fear, and there's, you know, there's rats and you know, snitches in every group or whatever. So what we have here is a culture of abortion, and its payback we're going to see later on when we get to the Exodus. All right. There was a man, start over in Exodus 2:1. Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi, and the woman conceived and bore a son with whom she saw that he was beautiful, and she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket and covered it over with tar and pitch. And she put the child into it and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. Now this is a real act of faith. She's basically putting her son on the waters and saying, God, if you don't rescue him, there's no way. So she could hide him no longer, we're told here. The sister stood at a distance to find out what happened to him. Then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe the Nile with her maidens walking along the Nile, saw the basket of reeds, sent her maid, and she brought it to her. Amram, the Levite, marries Jochebed, a woman of Levi. And their third child is born after the time of Pharaoh's edict. Miriam and Aaron have already been born. Pharaoh's daughter eventually names him Moses. Trusting God, Jochebed puts him in an ark of reeds and pitches and floats him down the Nile in a reed basket. Now, think about this as a strategy for saving your child. I mean, you gotta believe something. God's going to intervene somewhere along the line.
She had a dream.
There's some, well, I don't know. We're not told that, but there are crocodiles in the Nile, you know.
Yeah.
Miriam, his older sister, watches his progress until the basket is found by Pharaoh's daughter. Now, back to the text. When she, Pharaoh's daughter, opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying. She had pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women that she may nurse the child for you?" Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go ahead." So when the girl went and called the child's mother, Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I shall give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. The child grew. She brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses and said, "Behold, I drew him out of the water." Now, Pharaoh's daughter realizes this is a Hebrew child, and that it's his mother's attempt to save from Pharaoh's edict. Miriam's offer to find a wet nurse is very transparent. The child is returned to Jochebed until it's weaned. That means this child is now raised at home for a couple years. The people asking, "What's with this boy being here?" They're told, "Well, this is the daughter of Pharaoh's, the child of Pharaoh's daughter, and we're acting as wet nurse." The child's he is named Moses and is raised as an Egyptian prince. The Hebrew meaning of Moshe is drawn out. The Egyptian word simply means son. Means son. So like Tutmos means son of Thot. Amos means son of Ah. Ramses means son of Ra. That's why you see that MSS in all of these names, because that word means son. We have in our English language, we have Josephsons and Jeffersons and, you know, Stevensons, etc. if you're in Hebrew, you have been this and been that and been this and been that. And if you're in Arabic, you have Ibn this and Ibn that and Ibn this and Ibn that. Those are all designators for son of. It came about in those days when Moses had grown up that he went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So Moses is aware that he is Hebrew. He looked this way and that way, and then when he saw there was no one around, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. He went out the next day, and behold, two Hebrews were fighting with each other, and said to the offender, "Why are you striking your companion?" And he said, "Well, who made you a prince or a judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and said, "Surely the matter has become known." When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian, and he sat down by the well. In the movie Ten Commandments, there are characters that are biblical and characters that are not. The character who plays his Egyptian mother, the daughter of Pharaoh, is a biblical character. And Seti and Ramses are also probably biblical characters, or historical characters, what I mean. But Nefertiti is not. There is no reference in the Bible to someone like Nefertiti, nor any love affair between Moses and that sort of thing. In the movie Ten Commandments, you get the impression that he only discovers that he's Hebrew really late in the game. The chances are, the high likelihood is, the general belief is he's known he's Hebrew for most of his life.
How old is he at this point?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that I know, but he's an adult. He's an adult. He's been raised as a prince. I'm not sure I know. I might think about it, but I'm not sure I know.
I wonder if he was circumcised.
I don't know the answer to that either. I don't know the answer to that either.
That would have to do with him being aware that he was Hebrew.
Yeah.
Did they do that yet?
Yeah. No, that was the agreement with Jacob back at Bethel when God and he established the covenant. That was agreement with Abraham, back when God established the covenant with Abraham, that they would circumcise their firstborn.
Okay.
So
that wasn't a Jewish custom that just came up, or it was a Jewish custom?
It was a commandment by God for 1,000 years before that.
It had nothing to do with Judaism. It was just that it was...
Abraham is the father of the Jewish people.
Right.
Okay. So the Jewish practice of circumcision flows back to their relationship to Abraham.
Okay.
Now, it's also true, though, that other cultures circumcised. And we'll talk about that down the road just a little bit here. There were other cultures that circumcised, and some of them circumcised under certain circumstances. Sometimes it was the priests only who were circumcised. And sometimes it was everyone, but at the point of marriage. And we'll get to that in a little bit. Alrighty, so Moses apparently knows all about his Hebrew lineage. He observes and watches what is happening to them. He kills an Egyptian overseer to save a Hebrew from a beating. As they say, no good deed goes unpunished. When he later attempts to arbitrate between two Hebrews, he realizes that his murder of the overseer has been discovered. When Pharaoh finds out, Moses is forced into exile. He winds up in the land of Midian, who are the descendants of the fourth son of Abraham by Keturah. Remember that when Sarah died, Abraham marries Keturah, a Canaanite woman, and has six sons with her, all of whom are named, all of whom were given their inheritance and sent away upon their majority. And one of those sons is a man named Midian. And so Jethro and his people are the descendants of Abraham's son, Midian, which is why we see Jethro, the priest of Midian, basically educating Moses in the things of God, because Moses was raised in Pharaoh's court. So, Midianites were initially followers of Yahweh, who they learned about through their own patriarch, Abraham. They lived at the foot of the holy mountain, Sinai, which is also called Horeb. They were shepherds, as were Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob by trade. Now the priest of Midian, back to the text, the priest of Midian had seven daughters. They came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Then the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. When they came to Reuel, their father, Reuel is their Midianite name. These people all have many names. Jethro's name is Jethro. His name is Reuel. His name is also Hobab. So in the biblical text, he's called all three of these one time or another. Like Peter is called Peter, he's called Cephas, and he's called
Simon.
Depending on what culture you're speaking from. In Hebrew, he's Simon. In Greek, he's Cephas. In Latin, he's Peter. So, or Paul and Saul, you know, that sort of thing. So when they came to Reuel, their father, he said, why have you come back so soon today? You usually go out to water the flocks. You get pushed aside until all the male shepherds are done watering theirs, and then you get stuck with what's left over, but today you're back sooner. What happened? So they said, an Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds. What is more, he even drew the water for us and watered the flock. Now they describe him as what? An Egyptian. He's raised Egyptian, he looks Egyptian, he dresses Egyptian, his hair is Egyptian. He said to his daughters, where is he then? Why is it that you've left the man behind and invite him to have something to eat? Moses was willing to dwell with the man. He gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses. And then he gave birth to a son, and he named him Gershom, for he said, I've been a sojourner in a foreign land. So Gershom means sojourner. Reuel, a.k.a. Jethro, the priest of Midian, had seven daughters. Moses' arrival at age 40 provides the family with much-needed son. There's your answer. He marries Jethro's daughter Zipporah and lives in Midian as a shepherd for another 40 years. He names his firstborn son Gershom, which means sojourner, because he has lived as an alien in a foreign land. Later, the law of Moses has strong provisions for fairness and justice for aliens. Moses remembers his life in exile in a foreign land. God redeems all of our tribulations for his good purposes. So Moses' exile, 40 years, is designed to set him up to become the Moses of Sinai, the Moses who leads his people out of Egypt. Once again, we see that God takes the very difficult things in our life, and if we will trust him, or whether we won't trust him, he turns them to his purposes and for our good. You can't think that Moses, when he has to flee Egypt, where all of his support systems are, he has to flee Egypt, he has to go across the Sinai, he stumbles and finds himself to the foot of Mount Sinai, and there he is a penniless guy who winds up becoming a shepherd. Remember, this is a man who was raised as an Egyptian, and what would they say about shepherds? That the Egyptians found them to be disgusting. Yeah, so he has to become a shepherd. He's penniless. He has nothing to bring to this marriage. He becomes basically Jethro's servant. And we'll see this later when he has to ask Jethro's permission to leave, even though God has told him to go. So he lives this 40 years in a rather simple, contemplative life. But he was raised for 40 years in the palace of a king. We'll talk a bit more about this later. But his education, his pursuits, his entertainment, his everything about him was raised for high-end living in a palace. And he winds up for 40 years being a nobody on the backside of nowhere doing what he calls scut work. You know, we might think pig farmer. They might think shepherd. And there in that place over 40 years, he is changed and molded. Cecil B. DeMille has this one section where he's sort of trying to kill some time and set a tone for the movie. And it shows Moses struggling through the desert. And as he's struggling through, the sand is blowing him. He's getting knocked down. His beard's growing by the minute, you know, as he goes through. His clothes are getting all ragged and whatever. And there's this voice going, and in that great desert wasteland where God trains all prophets and whatever, you know, there's all this conversation about how God, like hammer on anvil and all this kind of stuff. And then it shows him basically collapsing at the foot of this well where these sheep are. However, he does seem to have the energy the next day to jump up and defeat a whole bunch of shepherds and for the sake of a couple of seven women. At any rate, it's an interesting story. But it's always stuck with me because next time you see the movie, look at that, because it sort of makes this point that God puts his people through very difficult times where he sands them, as it were, buffs them down, breaks them down, and whatever, for his purposes in order to remake them into what it is he wants them to be. And Cecil B. DeMille's description of that is really insightful. It's just melodramatic, but it's really insightful.
Dwayne, that's a lot like what we just finished studying with Joseph.
That's right.
He was raised as a favored son, and then he went through those 12 incredible years to begin with.
Yeah. This is a theme. It's, you know, same thing with Jacob, really. I mean, he goes from being fair-haired boy from his mama to having to, you know, live with a crooked father-in-law and brothers-in-law who are constantly lording it over him. And, you know, that's a theme. You think of Noah, for instance, having to put up with the ridicule and whatever of his entire community for 100 years while he's building a boat on a mountain. You know, thousands of miles from the sea in a place that had never seen rain. So, what this says to us is that God actually designs trouble for us. He designs circumstances for us that are designed to shape us into what we are meant to be. And we sort of have two choices with that. We can either kick, scream, yell, fight, and struggle, and whatever, and wind up winning ugly. Or we can agree with God in the process, trust God in the middle of it, and come out looking like Joseph. And there was a point in my life when I decided I was tired of winning ugly. Because God kept putting me through things that I would kick, scream, fight, yell, and whatever about. And then he would turn it into something good, and I'd go, well, never mind, you know. And I finally decided, you know what, God's got it, he's in charge. He knows what he's doing, so let me figure out what he's doing and try to cooperate with the process. Who knows, you might speed it up. So, at any rate, that's what he did here. So, during that 40-year period, he gets married, raises his father-in-law's flocks, has a child, has a life, does a lot of thinking, does a lot of forgetting about his old life and whatever.
So, you have it here at 40, so basically, his life as a shepherd plus the 40 he had before that, so he was 80 years old then.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's correct.
Okay.
Caleb was 80 years old before he made it to the hill country and began the process of driving out all the people before him. We're told that his life force was unabated and he was a warrior. So.
I bet this was a blessing to Jethro, you know, because, I mean, the seven daughters.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. 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 Well, not only does he find a son for one of his daughters, but the son doesn't leave and take the daughter. Because most cases, what would happen is he would just be, he'd be swapping daughters for sheep. You know, and he's got sheep. So, you know, one thing too, Bruce, back to your question. Remember, this is midlife. 80's midlife for him. I mean, I think he's 175 when he dies, if I remember correctly. Yeah, somewhere in that time frame.
Must have a good family practitioner.
Well, you know, he also wasn't raised up on sweets. You know, I mean, he was, but you know, these people worked hard and whatever. And he isn't the only person. I mean, this is typical.
I know.
in this particular age. In the we actually went downhill until we got to a lifespan of about 50, yeah. And now we're on our way back up to a lifespan of about 80 or so, you know. And remember, we talked about with Molly, you were here last week. Esther's grandmother is 115, and they've only had cancer in Kenya for the last 10 years in any kind of size or numbers, and that's because of the kinds of things that produce cancer in us and proliferated it had not yet come there, like all the sprays and stuff on their foods and, you know, stuff like that, the industrial, you know, smog and whatever. So God redeems all of our tribulations for his good purposes. Now it came about in the course of many of those days that the king of Egypt died. The sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God saw the sons of Israel, and he took notice of them. All right, I'm going to address the obvious question in a minute. But first let me say this. Eventually, in due season, at the death of Pharaoh, God remembers his people Israel. He hears their cry for deliverance. God is never in a hurry. Neither is he ever late. His timing is his own, and we can only trust him in it. In 2 Peter 3:9, this is the issue. It says, "The Lord is not slow about his promise, as some count slowness, but is patient towards you, not wishing for any to perish, but for all to come to repentance." In a number of places in the Bible, it says, "And in the appointed time, God raised up so-and-so." And for instance, there was an appointed time when he brought the Messiah into the world. And then there was an appointed time when he'll bring him back again. And so we wonder sometimes why God waits and why he tarries. And God waits and tarries because he is patient, and sometimes for reasons that surprise us. For instance, this process where he's getting ready to dump on the Egyptians comes after a prolonged period of time that he's giving the Egyptians to repent from their ways. And particularly one of the things we were talking about is their abortion society. When they fail to do that, then he brings judgment. Remember, the story of Jonah was a story of a man who was told by God to go and tell the citizens of Nineveh to repent. The citizens of Nineveh were as wicked and evil as any other group we've ever run into. But they chose to repent, and they were given another 60, 70 years because of their repentance. We're going to get into this story eventually, not in this book, but in the next one, and the next two, three actually, about God going, punishing all of the Amorites by taking away their land, killing their men, women, children, whatever. And there's all this grief that people want to give God because he's such a bloodthirsty person, that he goes in and he wipes out all these people. But we have to remember that he gave them 400 years to repent from their practices. You have to remember, too, that by the time we get to the Amorites of Joshua's day, that they have graduated from aborting their children for the sake of politics to aborting them on a regular basis for the sake of worship with their God. So that they might become prosperous. They have mothers and fathers voluntarily killing their newborns, throwing them into the pits and into the fires and into the over the cliffs and everything in Moloch worship and Pan worship and whatever. If you've ever been to Israel and you go to Caesarea Philippi, one of the big exhibits there is the Temple of Pan, and they talk a lot about this whole thing about the sacrificing of the children there. And what you get this, you begin to realize this becomes a way of life for a people. You also have the process at that particular point in time when all religious practice is based on perverse sexuality. So in order to worship their gods, they went and had sex, either in the temple, usually with a harajali, which is a prostitute, a temple prostitute, either male or female, that they hired for this particular purpose. So it's like, in the same way that when the world got to be so dark, God brought the flood. The same thing happens, that we see that he has great long times of patience in which he tries to reach out to people for them to change their ways. He waited a long time before he confronted Sodom and Gomorrah. So 2 Peter 3, the Lord is not slow about his promise, as some count slowness, but is patient towards you, not wishing that any would perish, but for all to come to repentance. God is not able, he's not unable to do that which he wants to do, but he's gracious and shows patience to give us an opportunity to repent. Well, it's the same God.
Yeah. But was he really different?
No, I don't think so.
Did he soften up in the New Testament?
No.
Did he just realize that people...
No, I don't think he's... it's the same God. I don't think he's softened up at all. I think, for instance, if you see him interfacing with his people in the New Testament, you see him showing grace. Mm-hmm. In fact, waiting to discipline shows grace. I don't know if you've ever... had a bad child or a difficult child, but you know, if you spank a difficult child, every time they get difficult, you're going to spend all your day beating them. So the point is that you have to sometimes wait and let things build up a little bit sometimes until they comes to a sort of a crisis point or whatever. But no, I don't. I know that it's popular to think of the God of the New Testament. We've had an overemphasis in our teaching in the West on the love of God in the New Testament. Jesus, little Jesus, meek and mild, Mother Mary's baby child, you know, and he's all this warm and fuzzy or whatever. Try to remember that it is Jesus who will be the judge of all the earth. It is Jesus who will send all the people to heaven or hell. It is God who gave us life and gave us all these things. The God of the Old Testament, what we're really looking at is not so much an evolution in the nature of God as an evolution in the nature of the culture. Yeah. Because, I mean, once we get to the New Testament where the light of God comes into the world, then in many, many ways we become better as a culture. It's popular to think that way, but I don't buy that the God of the Old Testament was a mean bastard and the God of the New Testament's this warm and fuzzy guy. You know. All right, Exodus 3, verse 1. Now Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. Remember they called him Reuel in the last chapter. And he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness, and he came to Horeb, the mountain of God, which they called Sinai in the last chapter. The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of the bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, and yet the bush was not consumed. So Moses said, I must turn aside now and see this marvelous sight, why the bush is not burned up. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses, and he said, Here I am. And he said, Do not come near here. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. He also said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. And we will see this virtually every time a spiritual person, being of some kind, shows up in the Bible, that the human will go down on their face without fail. They will humble themselves because the spiritual beings are awesome. They're in the true sense of the word, they're awesome. They're full. They're awe-inspiring. So Moses sees an angel in a burning bush on the slopes of Horeb in the Sinai desert. Miraculously, the fire neither consumes the bush nor burns out. When Moses approaches, he hears the voice of God. Like Abraham and Jacob, it portends a new life and a long journey. Remember that when God spoke out to Abraham, or God spoke out to in or the Chaldees, or if he spoke out to Jacob. This usually means that he's getting ready to establish a relationship with you, and you're on a journey. You know, you're getting ready to do that. And we should think of that personally. When God speaks to us in our heart, he'll redirect us onto a different journey, a different path. We can be very much about our own lives, and then God will interface with us, and now all of a sudden we're about his life. We're about what it is he's called us to do.
Why did you... I guess I'm reading the same thing you are, and You said Moses sees an angel in a burning bush. From what I read here, why isn't that God rather than an angel?
Because angels aren't God and God's not angels. It says here, an angel of the Lord appeared to him,
okay.
Verse 2,
okay.
And then it said God called to him from the bush.
Okay, well, that's why I was confused one time.
The bush is big enough for both of them, I guess.
Okay.
Well, it is kind of confusing because it says angel, then it says God.
Yeah. Well, don't be assuming that these are the same person.
Right.
He sees an angel in this bush, and then when he gets there, the voice of God calls out to him from the bush.
Right.
Okay.
Is that how it's happened in other things too? When the angels appeared, didn't Abraham hear God speak to him afterwards? Anywhere or no?
Abraham's initial contact with God was strictly from a voice. He saw nobody. The only time that Abraham ever saw God in any kind of form, he appeared as a human. He shows up for dinner and appears as a human. So he doesn't actually encounter, Joshua encounters an angel on the banks of the Jordan. That turns out to be Jesus, though. Mary encounters an angel, turns out to be an angel. Ezekiel encounters God, it turns out to be God, not an angel. So it's all different. All right. He and God, that's Moses and God, will meet here at this site many times. Because remember, this is where he brings them back. He goes to Egypt, he brings them back to this very site. And they're going to meet here many times, growing in relationship as friends. This is their first meeting, but they're going to have many on this site. God comes to Moses when he is but a common worker, but God has prepared him for many years through life's experience. He was born Hebrew, check. Raised and trained to govern, check. Learned in languages, reading and writing, check. Trained in pastoral skills as a shepherd, check. Humbled by his failures, check. And rendered thoughtful and reflective by his solitary life as a shepherd, away from the noise of the palaces and riches, and learned to fear the Lord, check, check. Okay? So this whole process that he's been through has prepared him for what comes next. That's not at all uncommon. Same thing with Joseph, same thing with Jacob, etc. Now, from that, what I take is that that's what he's trying to do with me. He's trying to prepare me for what comes next. So he does this, check, does this, check, does this, check. You know, he gives me this wife, check, all this stuff. It's just, all of these things are designed to prepare me for the thing that he's called me to. Just because we don't see the pattern sometimes doesn't mean there's not one there. And if we start to look for the pattern, we can see it. So I would encourage you to say to yourself, I wonder what it is exactly God's called me to do. What has he skilled me to do? What has he prepared me to do? What has he taught me to do? Not just in my career, but everything else. Because I can assume that God has a plan for my life and that he's been busy working on it even if we don't realize it. So I remember telling Nancy when Benjamin died, we are now qualified to help people with loss. I said that to her. And because up until that time, it's all theory. Mm-hmm. I know what you're feeling. No, you don't. You have no idea what I'm feeling. Don't have a clue. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have given heed to their cry because of their... Let me make another comment on that last point before I go on. When the doctor told me that I indeed had cancer, and then when they told me that it was terminal, that I had less than 5 years to live, at that particular point in time, my attitude, and Nancy's too, to some extent, was to say, this is interesting. I wonder what it means. This is that what are you doing thing, God, only it's not, what the hell are you doing, God? It's like, okay, now what are you about? What are you about? I remember thinking at the time, I had always thought I might live to see 65, but I guess not. And so I guess what's happening is that this next 4 or 5 years are designed for a purpose, and I need to figure out what it is so I can work with it. Well, one of the things, of course, that it prepared me to do was to help people who get into these terminal scenarios to say to them, you do not have to live in fear just because somebody's told you this is terminal, even if it is, that you can live with a peace that says, this is the plan of God, it's part of what he's doing, and he's, I can learn how to cooperate with this and go with this, and he'll make me useful in it. He'll use this. Now, theoretically, one of these days we're going to stand up at the throne of God, and he is going to ask us how many talents we have. And he's going to say, I gave you 5 talents, what do you have? I'm going to say, well, I got Margie talent, and I got Rick talent, and I got... No, I'm going to... You know, and a couple of Daniels, too, you know, I mean... Is it 2 Daniels to the talent? I mean, what's the deal? So, at any rate, but he's going to say, okay, show me what it is you have done with what I gave you in terms of skills and gifts and training and positioning and all the stuff that someone does to prepare someone for a place. And when he does, what I want to be able to do is to say, I took these 5 talents and I was able to make 10 out of them. That's what I want to do. I want to be able to say to him, okay, well, this is what you gave me and this is what I did with it. Now, the work, the body of work will speak for itself. I don't really have to say anything. It'll speak for itself. But the point is, I want there to be a body of work. I want there to be something where I can say, okay, this is what you gave me, and you gave me birth in America, you into a good home, and blah, 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 and this education, you gave me a good mind, and you gave me a good wife, and you gave me this and this, and you gave me cancer, and you gave me a dead child, and you gave me this and this and this, and all of these things you used to prepare me to do this, and this is what I've done. Is that what you wanted? Did I get it right? You see, and so I believe that the Bible is telling us, especially in these stories of people, that we should look at it that way, to say, there is a God in heaven. Psalm 139, he knew us before we were ever created. He planned for us before we ever created. He knew exactly how many days there were before there was one. He gave us all of this set of gifts and talents, each of us, uniquely, individually shaped and formed. Positioned us with the various people around us, educated us, brought us up in Ethiopia, brought us up in America, brought us up in Italy, brought us up wherever he brought us up. Okay, and he did all this sort of thing and to design us to be able to do a certain set of things that fit in the grand scheme of God's plan. And the question's going to be, did I get there or not? You know, did I wind up getting there or not? Did I do that? And we don't need to be afraid of that. We just need to keep it in mind and say, okay, Lord, show me what it is you'd have me to do. How would you have me to serve? Well, what is it, you know, what is it that I'm supposed to do? You know, if he taught you how to cook burgers, then cook burgers. You know, I mean, seriously. So the point is that, you know, all these things, and we'll never know really until we get there what the body of work is. But there'll be somebody who'll come along and he'll go, you know what, I was just lost and whatever, and I ran into Mr. So-and-so, my scoutmaster, and he was the one that got me on this right path. Or I was so-and-so or whatever, lost and whatever, I had no purpose. And then I saw there was a cooking team, and so I went over and joined the cooking team, and Bob Daniels and those guys, they were really good, and they showed me how to walk with the Lord. I was a drunk and whatever, and I went to live with an aunt, and she showed, you know, it's hard to know what the fabric or the tapestry is going to look like because it's in progress. But what we want is for there to be a fabric or a tapestry. We want to see that. We want there to be one. And we can't live in fear of it, but it really helps, I think. It will really help, I think, if we get there having understood this purpose and understood this process and asking God to show us how to cooperate with that. What is it you have us to do? Do we give money? Do we give our time? Do we touch this or that person? I mean, you know, the, was it Mozart's mother was a prostitute? You know, I think it's Mozart. He was the 14th child of a prostitute, you know, whatever. It's a long story. And, I mean, I've heard people talk about this and everything like that. And I think he was blind or whatever. It's one of these things that you talk about when you're talking about right to life and whether or not people have a life worth living. And they say, okay, they give you this story. Here's this kid, he's born blind. His mother's a prostitute, blah, 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 whatever. And should we abort this kid? You know, whatever. Well, you just killed Mozart. You know, that kind of thing. Whoever trained John Wesley did a good job, but you may not know who that is. Whoever raised Billy Graham, you know, they did a good thing. So, the Lord said, verse 7, the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and I have heard their cry come because of their taskmasters. For I am aware of their suffering, so I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians and to bring them up from that land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. So he's waited until this time to bring them to a place he's prepared for them that's presently inhabited by a bunch of other people whom he's getting ready to remove. And now, behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them. Therefore, come now, and I will send you to Pharaoh, so that you may bring my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? And he said, certainly I will be with you, and this shall be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain. So God has heard the cries of Abraham's people. Their taskmasters have been brought undue suffering upon them. He is now ready to honor his promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to give them the land of Canaan as an inheritance. Moses is very reluctant to take on such a role. He is known to be meek, even fearful of leadership. Would Pharaoh receive him and listen? What do you think? What do you think? Would Israel listen to him for that matter? Would the people of Israel? What do you think? God says, you and I outnumber them, Moses. Between you and me, we outnumber all of them. And it's an attitude that we would do well to develop, that me and God make a majority. When it comes to doing something God's told me to do, that me and God can overpower anything or anybody. I will go with you, and I will bring them back here on your journey to the promised land. So God says, you can go and bring them back because I will go with you. I will make it happen. And Moses said to God, behold, I'm going to the sons of Israel, and I shall say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. Now they may say, what is his name? What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am who am. In Hebrew, that would be Yahweh. I am who I am. And he said, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, I am has sent me to you. And God furthermore said to Moses, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial name to all generations. So for the first time in history, God gives his name to someone. Say to my people, I am has come to you. And I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The same covenantal God brought those people forward. So Moses asked God, what is his name? The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has never before named himself. They have always called him Adonai, or the Lord, specifically the Lord Most High, as to keep him separate from all the other gods that they believe were out there. It's not until the 8th century prophets that God begins to emphasize monotheism. Up until that time, God just lets it slide and deals with their understanding of multiple gods, with God being the God Most High. This is 1290. This is 500 years before, or 600 years before the 8th century. He was known as the fear of Isaac, God was, the person that Isaac respected. Moreover, he has always been merely a voice, except when he took on human form to walk among men. God reveals his nature in his name. Yahweh means I am that I am. That's where you get that YHWH in English. I am.
Correlation there.
Huh?
What's the correlation?
I am that I am means that I always was and always will be. My nature is that I am.
Okay, but how does that directly relate to YHWH?
Oh, that's how you would. That's what. If you said I am that I am in Hebrew, it would be Yahweh.
Oh, okay.
And Hebrew doesn't have vowels.
That's right.
And it just has. It has. Original Hebrew just has capital letters. 22 of them, remember? Yeah. And so it's Yaheh, Vav, and He. So as time went on, remember this was an oral language for most of its early existence. And it wasn't until they began writing it that they needed some sort of vowel designator. And so they put in vowel points, and then later on they borrowed letters from the Arabic language and put in vowels themselves. But originally it was just vowel points. I think I've done this for you before, but the if you have YHW H. And then you put in a vowel point here, and you put in a vowel point here, and a vowel point here to tell you what to say between the continents. And then you change this through language into Latin. It becomes, the Y becomes J's, the H stays an H, the W's become V's, and the H stays H, and it becomes Jehovah. That's where you get Jehovah. It's just Yahweh changed into Latin with the vowels added. J-H-V-H is Y-H-W-H. You know how German pronounces its W's as V, whatever. This is typical. You remember the mnemonic I-N-R-I? You remember what I-N-R-I is? This was the four letters that were above Jesus' head on the cross. It stands for Jesus Nazarenus Rex Judaeorum. Well, you see that the I's became J's. The Jesus, the Greek name for Jesus is Jesus, I-E-S-U-S. And the Greek name of the Judeans is I-U-D-E-O-R-A-M, Iudorum. So this becomes Jesus of Nazareth, Rex, King of the Jews. So that's just linguistics. And the translation there is, I am that I am. It means that he is eternally existent and eternally self-sufficient. His name reveals his nature. I am that I am. Seven I am statements of Jesus in John are freighted with this meaning. When John emphasizes what Jesus did in his life, one of the things that he emphasizes is the seven I am statements. In fact, a number of times when Jesus said, I am, people would fall on their butt. Because he would turn and he would say, I am this, and they would fall down. If you read your scriptures, because he was speaking in the power of God, the name of God. So when John emphasizes these seven I am statements as the center of his gospel, and he said, I am the bread of life, I am the light of the world, I am the door, I am the good shepherd, I am the resurrection and life, I am the way and the truth and life, and I am the true vine. Those are the seven thematic, the seven themes of John's gospel that he wraps his gospel around, that and seven miracles. So, verse 16, go gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I am indeed concerned about you and what has been done to you in Egypt. So I said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt, the land of Canaanite, Hittite, Amorite, Perizzite, Hivite, Jebusite, to a land flowing of milk and honey. So once again, he promises, I'm going to give you this land that is presently occupied by these people. Now, you and I both know, because we are students of history, because we look back, that there's another 40 years before this is actually going to happen. They will pay heed to what you say. You with the elders of Israel will come to the king of Egypt, and you will say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us, so now please let us go a 3 days journey in the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. But I know that the king of Egypt will not permit you to go, except under compulsion. So he's telling you, my foreknowledge is that he's going to give you trouble. So I will stretch out my hand, and I will strike Egypt with all my miracles, which I do shall do in the midst of them. And after that he will let you go. And I will grant this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And it shall be that when you go, you will not go empty-handed, but every woman shall ask of her neighbor, and the woman who lives in her house, articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing, and you will put them on your sons and daughters. Thus will you plunder the Egyptians. So, interesting piece here. Go first and gather the elders of Israel and announce the day of deliverance has come. I'm ready to give you the promised land. Then go to Pharaoh and tell him to let my people go. But Pharaoh will not listen or obey me without compulsion. So I will smite the Egypt with my miracles, and then he will let you go. I will grant you favor in the eyes of the Egyptian people, and they will give you enormous wealth as you leave. It sounds like a Jedi mind trick, but it's really only justice, because they have been enslaving them for 200 years and not paying them. So what God is saying is I will make them pay up all of your wages for 200 years, as you leave. They weren't slaves for 400 years. They were just there for 400 years. Remember, they were in Egypt for 400 years, but they were in high cotton for 150 to 200 of those years. It wasn't until after the Hyksos had gone and some time had passed before they began to be enslaved. Are you with me? So, this principle of sowing and reaping, this principle of justice, God is huge on justice. And as much as God loves mercy, he requires justice. So one of the things that we need to be concerned about as a people is, while we very much want God to show us mercy, God must have justice. And that which we have done to these innocent children, we will pay for this. It must happen. Somebody once said that if God does not deal with America, he'll have to wake up Sodom and Gomorrah and apologize to them. All the slave labor is to be repaid to Israel. All they have stolen from you will be returned. This is also promised to Israel after the second coming. The biblical promises and the prophets from Israel's second coming is, everything that's been done to you will be restored to you. Everything that's been taken from you will be given back to you. And the nations will bow down to you in that day when Jesus the King of Israel comes and rules and reigns. So let me read Isaiah 60 and we'll quit. Verse 12. For the nation and the kingdom which will not serve you will perish. Look at Germany. Okay? Look at the Nazis. God help us if we decide, or God help us when we decide to stand against Israel. The nation that will not serve you will perish. The nations will be utterly ruined. The glory of Lebanon will come to you, the juniper, the box tree, the cypress together, to beautify the place of my sanctuary. I shall make the place of my feet glorious. The sons of those who afflicted you will come bowing to you. All those who despise you will bow themselves on the soles of your feet. They will call you the city of the Lord, the Zion of the Holy One of Israel. Whereas you have been forsaken and hated with no one passing through, I will make you an everlasting pride, a joy from generation to generation. You will suck the milk of the nations. You will suck the breasts of kings. And you know that I, the Lord, am your Savior, your Redeemer, the Mighty One of Jacob. Isaiah 60. Okay. Comments? Yes, ma'am.